Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Friday, August 29th. I'm Sigurd Bjørn, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, California Attorney General and Providence square off in Humboldt Court over emergency abortion services. Dillon Fire grows to over 4,000 acres as firefighters suppress dozens of lightning-induced fires in Siskiyou County. Humboldt budget shortfall is adversely affecting the county's employees. And all the week's sports updates as football season kicks off this weekend. Stay tuned, these stories and more coming up. We'll start at the Humboldt County Courthouse, where the state's attorney general and lawyers for Providence St. Joseph squared off today over the hospital's commitment to provide emergency abortion services in accordance to a court-ordered stipulation and California law. As KMUD has reported before, the attorney general is suing St. Joseph's Eureka for refusing Ann Nuschlag what has been called a life-saving abortion when she was 15 weeks pregnant and sent her away while bleeding with a bucket and towels. We have our reporter Ryan Hudson on the line, who was in court today to follow proceedings. Ryan, can you tell us what the lawyers for the hospital had to say about the agreement?
St. Joe's attorneys asserted that the agreement failed to incorporate the ethical and religious doctrine that the hospital argues it is bound by and cannot violate. So, you know, that involves canons of religious doctrine that they expect doctors who are contracted to work within that hospital system, they expect those doctors to adhere to those religious canons.
What was the attorney general's sort of counter argument to this?
Well, the attorney general would argue that it does encompass abortion care as part of an emergency procedure related to a pregnancy emergency, specifically with the case of Anna Nuschlag. St. Joe's attorneys do not agree with that. They basically assert that the ESL law does not specifically require abortions as part of emergency care, despite the fact that abortion is the emergency care remedy recommended in cases like Nuschlag. And that was sort of one of the bones of contention. The AG's office was really relying on and kept circling back to the idea that Providence St. Joe's Health and St. Joseph and Eureka specifically have entered into an agreement and now are trying to renege on that agreement, while St. Joe's is saying, on the one hand, that they don't intend to skirt that agreement. They still intend to operate within the bounds of law, but they don't believe that that agreement properly acknowledges the ethical and religious directives that they want to be incorporated in the agreement.
And what was the atmosphere like?
It was a pretty full house. People in attendance were obviously there for Anna Nuschlag, who was also in the courtroom present for the hearing. As far as the tone in the room, there was some palpable tension. There were, you know, a couple times I could tell that people behind me in the audience were sort of jeering and having a bad reaction to statements made by the representation for St. Joseph's Hospital. And so that didn't go over well with the judge.
Did the judge rule in one way or another?
It appeared to me that the AG's office may have expected the judge to agree and simply uphold the existing stipulation and order. And instead of doing that, having heard St. Joseph's representation say that they have a First Amendment claim to a freedom of religion exception, essentially, to the emergency services law, felt inclined to offer them an opportunity to argue that point. So at the conclusion of the hearing, it was decided by the judge that yes, the Attorney General's office is required to go forward with the preliminary injunction hearing. They have 90 days from today to notice that hearing. So, in the interim, that stipulated agreement is in place. And St. Joseph's had said, represented to the court that they have and will continue to abide by the stipulated agreement.
Was anything brought up in court today that would suggest that the hospital has denied somebody emergency abortion care during this period?
No, and that was, I do believe the judge inquired about that to the Attorney General's office. And I do believe their reply was that they were unaware of any specifics to that effect.
Thank you, Ryan, so much for covering this for us, this event today at the courthouse. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The Dillon Fire burning either side, the Dillon Fire burning either side of Highway 96 in Siskiyou County has been active for 4 days now. It's grown to over 4,000 acres since it started on August 25th, and almost 900 acres overnight. CAL FIRE says its top priority remains the safety of the public and firefighters. Today's focus has been structure protection and construction of control lines close to those structures. Firefighters have also been working with resource advisors and cultural resource specialists to ensure natural and cultural resources are protected. The north side of the fire has been especially challenging due to inaccessibility. Evacuations are in effect for zones 1402A, 1405, 1503A, 1506, and 1509B. Evacuation warnings are also in place for several zones. For a complete overview, please go to our website, kema.org, and click on our Fire Resources tab, where you can see updated information on fires in the area. The weather will continue to be dry and warm with temperatures in the mid-80s. Relative humidity will remain in the upper teens, and wind gusts up to 25 miles an hour are possible. Throughout the course of the week, firefighters have detected 34 lightning fires in the Klamath National Forest, suppressing 29 of them. Containment efforts have proved challenging for the remaining five fires, including the Blue Fire, a 134-acre, 0% contained fire burning northeast of the Dillon Fire. The threat of thunderstorms could re-enter the picture by next Tuesday. Humboldt County is dealing with a budget shortfall that is having a severe effect on county staff morale, as Daniel Mintz reports.
Humboldt County's budget funding issues are taking a toll on its workforce, with a recent survey showing a strained workforce feeling undercompensated, overworked, and disconnected from leadership. Presented to the Board of Supervisors at its August 26th meeting, the survey reports a 20 percentage point drop in employees' intent to stay with the county compared to a similar survey conducted 2 years ago. According to human resources staff, that's a sign of growing attrition risks. According to the survey, the county's workforce is moderately engaged overall, but a deeper look at the data shows troubling trends. The most significant finding was the Employee Net Promoter Score, a standard industry metric for measuring satisfaction, which was negative. That means detractors, employees likely to speak negatively about their workplace, significantly outnumber promoters, as explained by human resources staffer Roseanne Ruiz Cortez.
In our case, our Net Promoter Score is in the negative. Meaning detractors outnumber promoters. And in our case, that ratio is almost 4-to-1. As you can read on the screen, this implies that, or suggests rather, that we have a dissatisfied workforce and there's potentially issues with organizational culture management or employee engagement.
The survey also shows high burnout levels, and human resources development manager Jeremy Clark told supervisors, quote, "One thing that is critically clear is that our staff is reaching their limits in terms of capacity." Clark related some of the staff comments included in the survey.
There are comments, several comments of folks saying, my job used to be done by three people. We lose people, they don't get replaced. I'm having trouble functioning after work when I go home to my family because the requirements of the job are so much. And I understand that we are limited in terms of what we can do, primarily from a budgetary standpoint. But our obligation to staff is to sort of elevate these issues. Aside from that, one of the things that we noticed, and I'm not just reporting this because it happens to be an area that I lead, but it was clear that some of the things that we're doing on the development side, whether that be supervisor academies or some of our learning labs, are really resonating with folks, and they'd sort of like to see that expanded. They also feel like there's some opportunity for some leadership training at sort of the manager and executive level and higher. The compensation issues are really complex and quite honestly beyond the scope of my responsibility, but what I can say is that in addition to feeling sort of capacity limitations, work limitations, they're also feeling like staff are not really recognized for their efforts.
Recommendations based on the survey results include looking at ways to better support staff and optimize the employee experience. Clark said a main recommendation is to, quote, implement a values-based recognition program. As, quote, a clear finding is that our staff do not really understand how what they do every day contributes to the goal achievement of the county. Supervisors linked the survey results to the county's budget situation, as discussed by Board Chair Michelle Bushnell.
Right now, where we are, you know, having to do more with less, and we're at a 10% hiring freeze, and our budget years, we don't know what that's going to look like. We've been saying that for like 3 years. I don't know why anybody would want to recommend come to the county, maybe see if you get laid off next year. So I think that has to also come into play with the dissatisfaction with willing to recommend people work at the county. I do think that that also plays into, you know, do more with less, and that was the idea of closing departments on Fridays if we could. But it has been, for a year and a half, kind of a somber message that we're in budget crisis and we had a status quo budget this year. And so that is not a comfortable feeling for anyone. And I'm not surprised that the survey reflects that. It honestly, if it didn't, I would be surprised.
Employee surveys have been done over many years, with this one receiving a record number of responses from 941 employees. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Thank you, Daniel. Next up is the National Native News, which includes a story about a man reuniting with his family after a 50-year separation. Here is Antonia Gonzalez.
A tearful and emotional reunion took place recently in Manitoba. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, a Scoop survivor was reunited with his Indigenous family after 50 years.
Jonathan Hooker was taken from his family in 1975. He was 2 months old. He is from the Mosakahiken Cree Nation in northern Manitoba. His new middle-class white family moved to New Zealand when he was 18 months old. Hooker always knew he was adopted but was never able to locate his birth mother. That is, until an ancestry test, which led him to make contact with his half-sister who lives in Texas.
So hopefully somebody else, again, from will see this and hopefully maybe start looking for their family, or it'll give them some clues to reach out and help.
Hooker had tried to find his natural family a few years ago on a visit to Canada, but without success. This time he was embraced by his biological mother, Patsy George, when he arrived at the airport in Winnipeg.
I thought I would never see him again. He was only 2 months old when they took him away from me and my other daughter, a month old.
George also recently found out that Hooker was married and had children. She said she would see her grandchildren one day. It's believed that about 300,000 Indigenous children were taken from their homes in a government operation known as the 60s Scoop. Many were placed with non-Indigenous families across Canada and around the world. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A haunting crime story and an Alaska Native legend are at the center of a new documentary that will premiere on the streaming platform Hulu next month. Ayulna Naiden with the Alaska Desk has more on the film, which is called Blood and Myth.
Blood and Myth looks into a real-life crime case that happened in Northwest Alaska over a decade ago. James Domick Jr. is the executive producer of the new documentary.
It's just an incredible story of survival and legends and violence and culture.
Domick worked at KNBA for 3 years, starting in 2016. During his time there, a co-worker asked him if he knew any Alaska stories that would make a good podcast. Domick told him about Teddy Kyle Smith, the Inupiaq actor from Kayana. In 2012, troopers were investigating the suspicious death of his mother when Smith fled to a cabin and had a violent encounter with two hunters. He was later convicted of attempted murder. Smith said that Inukuns, or little people, guided his actions. Domick described the incident in his 2019 audiobook called Midnight Sun. The new Hulu documentary is a movie adaptation of the audiobook. Domick grew up in Kotzebue, hearing about the little people, creatures that exist in various legends from Inuit groups across the globe.
If all of us had the same story and we're all so spread out, it might have air of truth to it.
In the film, Domick says he also wanted to highlight the issue of justice in rural Alaska, where the state struggles to provide a consistent law enforcement presence. Domick says that Blood and Myth is a true crime documentary told through an Indigenous perspective, which is rare in today's entertainment industry.
This is the type of story I wanted to see, and no one was making it. So I made it for me. Everyone else is invited to listen and watch, but at the end of the day, it's something I made for me.
Domick has worked in film production, but being an executive producer in his own film is a first for him. He says he wondered if it was his story to tell, but decided to do it after talking to his family and elders in his community. In Anchorage, I'm Alona Naiden.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
And here is Ray Hamill, standing in the end zone, waiting to take us over the line with his report on the start of the football season.
The local high school and college football seasons are finally here as we get set for a busy weekend of action here on the North Coast. Hello and welcome to this week's KMUD News Sports Report. I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com. We'll have more on all of the upcoming games in just a moment as we take a look at all of this week's big local sports stories in what was a busy week, including where one local baseball star is taking his talents next, some local high school and college soccer, some volleyball news, some motorsports news, and why it was a good week for one Southern Humboldt adult softball team. But first up, are you ready for some football? This weekend sees several local teams kick off the new season, including College of the Redwoods. The CR men will begin a new era for the program on Saturday afternoon when they host Sacramento City College in their season opener. Redwoods, which will play all of its home games at the Redwood Bowl at Cal Poly Humboldt once again this fall as construction continues on their athletic facilities, is making the jump from the American Division to the more competitive National Division this fall, which opens up the possibility of competing for a state championship. After the team posted back-to-back bowl game victories over the past two seasons for the first time in almost 50 years, head coach Jason White felt it was time to make the switch. Saturday's game, which is the first of five home regular season games for the team, is set for 1 p.m. Several local high school teams will also be in action this weekend, including a pair of intriguing all-local matchups. Five-time defending Big Four champion Del Norte will kick off the new season at home against Hoopa on Friday night at 7:30, while 24 hours later, defending state champion Arcata will host Eureka at McKinleyville High School. The Tigers graduated several key players from their state title-winning roster, but dynamic quarterback Luke Lemke is back under center for his senior season and should only continue to cause opposing defenses problems with his passing and scrambling ability. The Loggers, meanwhile, will be hoping to challenge for a Big Four championship on their second-year head coach Sam Edmonds, after they turned the corner on a couple of difficult seasons last fall. Also in action this weekend, Fortuna opens at St. Helena on Friday night at 7, while the McKinleyville Panthers will be hoping to record their first win since 2022 when they host Fort Bragg in their season opener at home on Saturday afternoon at 2. St. Bernard's Crusaders will also be in action on Saturday afternoon at 2 when they open the new campaign at home against Clear Lake. South Fork and Ferndale both have byes this weekend. Ferndale will kick off the new season at Fort Bragg next weekend, while South Fork opens at home against Happy Camp in 2 weeks. Some of the Mendocino County schools will also be in action this weekend. The Willits Wolverines open their new season at Piner on Friday night, while, as previously stated, Fort Bragg will open on the road at McKinleyville on Saturday afternoon. The Ukiah Wildcats also will be in action, opening on the road at Rancho Cotati on Friday night. On a side note, the local Football Officials Association announced this week that they will be honoring a former member this fall. Earlier this year, former HDNL official Craig Lempster passed away from colon cancer, and to honor his memory and his contribution to football in our area, the local football officials will wear a memorial patch in his honor throughout the regular season. In local baseball news, meanwhile, former St. Bernard's and College of the Redwoods standout Bodie Joyner recently announced that he will be taking his talents to the Division II collegiate level. The 2021 St. Bernard's graduate, who played at Napa Valley College as a freshman, is coming off a big sophomore season for CR, where he was the team's lone representative on the Golden Valley Conference All-Conference team. Joyner will join a competitive Jamestown University program in North Dakota, where he will play first base for the Jimmies. In local high school soccer, the Eureka Loggers kicked off the new boys' season with a pair of ties in the Bay Area this past weekend. On Friday, the Eureka boys played at Jewish Community High School in San Francisco and tied 1-1 before playing the Bay School at Kezar Stadium the following day and tying 0-0. The Loggers will continue their preparation for the upcoming HDNL campaign when they join several other local teams at this weekend's McKinleyville tournament. In local high school volleyball, the Eureka girls played their home opener on Tuesday night and defeated the Ferndale Wildcats in straight sets, winning 25-11, 25-13, 25-10. Defending Little 5 champions, the St. Bernard's Crusaders, also were in action this week and defeated a scrappy McKinleyville team in straight sets on Wednesday night, winning 25-17, 25-23, and 25-23. The Big 5 and Little 5 schools will begin conference play early next month. This week, the HDNL also announced new ticket prices for games for the upcoming school year. Tickets for adults have increased from $8 to $10 due to the continued increase in costs for the local high school athletic programs, league officials said. Ticket prices for students and seniors remain at $5. Switching gears, this weekend will be a big one for local motorsports fans with the second-to-last racing night of the season at the Redwood Acres Raceway. Saturday night's action will see the NorCal Legend Series visit the local track for the second time this year. A packed night of racing will also include the Late Models, Bombers, Junior Legends, Mini Stocks, and the Dirt 4 Bangers. In local college soccer, meanwhile, the Cal Poly Humboldt women are ranked number 6 in the California Collegiate Athletic Association preseason poll. It was announced this week. The Jacks, who have qualified for the conference tournament in each of the past 3 seasons, opened the new campaign with a non-conference showdown at home against Dominican on Thursday of next week. In local high school girls soccer, defending North Coast Section Division 3 champion St. Bernard's posted an impressive victory over a Big 4 school this week, opening the new campaign with a 3-0 win at Fortuna on Monday. And rounding out a busy week of local sports, it was a good week for one local women's adult softball team. On Sunday, T-Rev capped an undefeated summer with a 13-12 win over Cool Cats in the Southern Humboldt Women's League Championship game in Redway. And that's this week's KMUD News Sports Report. Until next time, I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks to our engineer, and thanks to our reporters, Ryan Hudson, Daniel Mintz, Antonia Gonzalez, Dan Karpenchuk, Alina Naden, and Ray Hamill. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Sigurd Björn. Thank you for listening.
KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commute. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org.
Redwood Community Radio is funded by Press Forward, a national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news.